For the rest of this hour, we'll pull our lens back from Washington and take a look at the big picture. And I mean the really big picture. Two projects are keeping astronomers around the world busy as they try to map the large structures of the universe. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which began in 2000, is an ambitious attempt to map one quarter of the sky. The completed map will show the locations of 100 million celestial objects. The second project, the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey, is using photographic images to map 2 degrees, and just for scale, the moon is a half a degree in the sky, so this is to map 2 degrees of the sky. Joining me now to talk more about these projects and what we've learned and hope to learn from them are my guests. Michael Strauss is the project spokesperson for the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. He's also a professor of astronomy at Princeton University, where he joins us by phone. Thanks for talking to us today, Dr. Strauss.
I'm glad to be here.
And David Weinberg is a professor of astronomy at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. He joins us by phone from Paris. Thanks for working late for us today, Dr. Weinberg.
Pleasure to be here. Always enjoy the show when I get a chance to hear it.
Well, I'm glad. And I assume you're in France for the Tour de France, of course.
Of course. and a little bit of science on the side.
Oh, okay.
Giving Lance Armstrong a hard time, indeed.
I see. All right. Well, I guess he's not going to be in Paris for a day or two, so you're free to do other things until then, I guess. So maybe, David Weinberg, I could start with you. You have an article in this week's Science about two projects attempting, the two projects we just mentioned, attempting to map the universe. First of all, let's talk about the one Dr. Strauss isn't involved with, the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. What's the aim of that project? And does it have a better name? Because if I have to say that each time we bring it up, it's going to be a long show.
Well, the astronomers have mostly taken to calling it the 2DF survey, for
okay,
short.
I can deal with that.
And this 2-degree field is actually the amount of sky that it covers at one shot. And they've actually done observations, many consecutive observations, to cover a pretty large area of sky. And the goal of this project is to make a large three-dimensional map of the universe, and that's also one of the goals of the Sloan survey. So if you take pictures on the sky, if you're looking very far out outside of the Milky Way galaxy, the basic unit that you see are other galaxies, collections of stars that are held together by gravity. And so from the pictures, you can see where they are in two dimensions, and then you have to do an additional measurement individual to each galaxy to figure out its distance. And so this 2-degree field survey used a special purpose instrument that allowed them to measure distances to galaxies about 400 at a time, and so they selected galaxies from these photographs and then measured their distances to build up this three-dimensional map, and their map had about 250,000 galaxies in it. And that survey has just been completed, although some of the analyses of it are still being done.
We're talking this hour about, or for the rest of the hour, about mapping the skies, and you're welcome to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Maybe David Weinberg, just one other question about the 2DF. Why only 2 degrees? Is it because it's such a big job to do more of the sky?
Yeah, so in the end, the total area that they covered was actually something like 1,000 square degrees, I think. And so it's just that when you have a big telescope, usually, the bigger the telescope, the smaller the patch of sky that it sees at any one time. And so what they had to do was build a special instrument so that they could see an area that's something like 15 times the size of the full moon at one go, in which they would have 400 galaxies, bright galaxies whose distances that they could measure. But then they use the telescope over and over again to actually cover this larger area. So in the end, it's the size of this 2DF survey is about 25% of the final size of the Sloan survey.
I got it. Okay. Michael Strauss, then, tell us a little bit about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and what you learn from it that you don't get from the 2DF.
Well, the Sloan survey has two aspects to it. One is like what you just heard from David, namely measuring the galaxies one by one, measuring the spectra of the galaxies to determine their distance. But a step before that is to get much more comprehensive information than was available from the photographs that the 2DF survey used. The Sloan survey telescope also has what's called an imaging camera that takes pictures of the sky and makes a more or less complete census of all the objects giving off visible light in the nighttime sky. And so that becomes a much more sort of broad-based set of data to address a much larger range of different scientific questions. Both surveys have as one of their goals the mapping of the large-scale distribution of galaxies, as David was explaining. But in addition to that, the Sloan survey can ask a much broader range of questions, having images of stars and quasars and asteroids and a variety of other different objects. And so it has turned out to address a much broader range of questions.
You know, I'm curious, the telescope that's being used here is in Apache Point, which I guess is in New Mexico, is that right?
Southeast New Mexico.
Is this a special kind? What's the optimum kind of telescope, or could you use any telescope? You just happen to have one that you can dedicate to this project?
It is a dedicated telescope, and that's one distinction, but indeed it is a special telescope. As David was just explaining, the field of view of the telescope, the 2 degrees that the 2DF survey makes reference to, is an important ingredient in all this, and indeed the equivalent number for the Sloan telescope is actually 3 degrees across. It actually turns out to be a little bit bigger in that respect. The other thing that counts in, when one's talking about a telescope is the size of its primary mirror. That is, and that's just a measure of how much light it can gather from any given object at a time. The size of the field of view tells you how many objects it can look at one time. And so it's sort of a combination of those two. So for the Sloan Survey Telescope, the primary mirror has a diameter of 2.5 meters, about 8 feet across. And indeed, the telescope that's used for the 2DF is the Anglo-Australian Telescope in Australia, and that has a diameter of 4 meters, which is, I don't know, what does that work out to, about 13 or 14 feet across. It's actually a somewhat bigger telescope.
And remind us how much of the sky the Sloan survey is going to look at?
Just about one quarter of the full sphere. You can, when one looks up at the night sky, one sees half the sphere, the remaining part of the sphere being beneath our feet. But as the Earth goes around the sun, and as one travels to the southern hemisphere, one can see the rest of that sphere. We're covering about a quarter of the full celestial sphere. And in particular, we're focusing largely, although not exclusively, in those regions away from the Milky Way, where the Milky Way, interesting though it may be, blocks our view of distant galaxies and quasars.
Okay.
Michael's talked about the telescopes, but the other thing that's very special with the Sloan survey is the instruments that go on that telescope. So it's got this quite massive camera that uses detectors that are like those in your digital camera, but are very much bigger and more sensitive.
David Weinberg, I have to cut you off for a second. We're going to continue this discussion, and we'll be taking your calls, but we have to take a short break. Please stay with us. We're talking this hour about mapping the universe. My guests are Michael Strauss, a professor of astronomy at Princeton University, and David Weinberg. He's a professor of astronomy at Ohio State University. Right now he's staying up in Paris in the late or the early Paris evening, I guess, to join us. And David Weinberg, you were just telling us a bit about what makes the Sloan Sky Survey Telescope special. And you were saying one of the things is a pretty sophisticated camera. Was there something else?
Yes, so the other is this very clever instrument that makes it possible to measure 640 galaxy distances at a time by using optical fibers that are plugged into steel plates to effectively make this one telescope act like it's 640 telescopes working in parallel. So you need these clever instruments, and then the other thing is just we couldn't have done this survey a decade and a half ago because even if we could have collected the data, computers wouldn't have been powerful enough to keep up with it. So it's also the advances in computer technology and software that make it possible to actually make sense of these maps as you collect the data.
All right. I'd like to invite our listeners to join us on this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go first to Richard in St. Louis. Richard, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. This is a great topic. There's a question I've had about this kind of stuff for ever since Astronomy 101 in college, and that is the further out we're looking, say we're looking out 500, even 1,000 light years, obviously we're looking into the past. Is there any kind of modeling that's going on to understand what's going on in these areas that are so far out now. I mean, essentially we're looking at a picture of, you know, thousands if not millions of years ago. Is it even relevant to say what's it look like now, or we have no way of knowing?
Interesting. So if I understand that, Michael Strauss, do you understand what Richard is asking?
That's a very good question.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. Astronomers use telescopes as time machines. The light that we see from distant objects has taken a certain amount of time to reach us, and we're seeing the objects as they were when the light was emitted, not as they are now. And so the way astronomers tackle those sort of general questions is they make a general comparison between relatively nearby objects, where we know that light travel time delay is relatively small, and very distant objects. And then we can ask sort of basic questions about if we think we're looking at the same class of objects, we can ask how those objects have changed with time. We can really watch the universe evolve in very real terms. And here it's worth pointing out that you were talking about thousands and millions of years, but in fact the numbers are even larger than that. And the most distant objects that the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has found have been quasars, which are being seen far enough back in time that one is approaching the time of the Big Bang. We know now that the Big Bang, that is the beginning of the present-day expansion of the universe, started about 14 billion years ago, and the most distant objects that we're seeing them at a time about less than a billion years after the Big Bang. We're looking back roughly 95% of the way back to the Big Bang. And it has been very interesting to ask exactly the question that you just posed, which is how different was the universe back then to the relatively nearby and therefore present-day universe that we see around us now.
Okay, Richard, you satisfied?
I think so. it's a huge question mark for me, though. Is when he's talking about looking far that back?
Yes.
Or looking back that far? We really, I guess, don't have an image or any kind of way to know what that same section of space would look like now.
Well, the difficult thing there is making the connection between the objects we see at great distances and therefore back in time to their equivalents today. And you see, for example, a distant galaxy and a relatively nearby galaxy, and you say, are we really looking at the same population of objects, or can we really draw a line between this object and that object or not? And that turns out to be one of the problems that really vexes us. So you've really hit the nail on the head as to one of the big problems that we find ourselves trying to address.
Good work there, Richard. I'm sure your Astronomy 101 professor would be very happy. Let's go to Mike in New York City. Mike, welcome to the program.
I have a question actually for both Dr. Weinberg and Dr. Strauss. It wasn't clear when you described the part of the sky that your respective experiments were covering. Do your two experiments overlap in any part of the sky coverage which they're looking at? And if yes, do the two experiments complement each other in any way that you would get additional information by using the data coming from both experiments?
Why don't I ask?
And I'll take the answer off the air.
Oh, okay, thanks. Well, why don't I ask David Weinberg to tackle that one to start with?
So I think the answer is the two surveys cover mostly different areas because one telescope is in Australia, so it sees the southern sky, and one telescope is in New Mexico, so it sees the northern sky. But there is an area near the equator where they overlap, and there's also a collaborative effort between the two projects where images that the Sloan has taken along the equator are being used to find objects that are then being followed up with the telescope that's been used for the 2DF survey. So there is some overlap between them, but mostly they're covering different areas. But you can still do statistical comparisons. You can ask, is the kind of clustering of galaxies that you see in the northern hemisphere with the Sloan survey similar to the clustering of galaxies that you see in the southern hemisphere with the 2DF survey? And part of what we think about the universe is that it really doesn't have special places or special directions. And so if you're getting a statistically fair sample, you should eventually see the same thing whichever direction you look.
Huh.
It's worth adding there.
Michael Strauss, go ahead.
Indeed, the two, more or less, the two groups are coming to broadly similar conclusions. There's no dramatic differences, I think, that anyone is claiming between the two results.
All right. Let's take another call now from Scott in South Bend, Indiana. Scott, welcome to Science Friday. What's your question?
Hi. My question is regarding the distances to these
objects. I know, or I believe historically, we've needed two separate locations with telescopes to determine the angle to the objects to determine distances. But in regards to the filter or the telescope that was mentioned earlier with the 640 different mini telescopes, basically with the metal grate or whatever is used, are you saying that grate in itself can measure those tiny angulation differences and determine the distance to these objects?
Let's see if Michael Strauss can tackle that.
Yeah, that is not how it works. What you're talking about is the effect that's sometimes called parallax, whereby for relatively nearby stars, as one perspective changes, and this is typically done as the Earth goes around the sun, one can get a different perspective on stars from one side of the sun to the other. One can see the small changes in angle. For the galaxies and distant objects that we're talking about, that effect is so tiny as to be completely unmeasurable. And so the technique that's used is quite a different one. One measures a quantity called the redshift of each galaxy, which is an effect in the spectrum that's due to the fact that the universe is expanding. And here we're using the fact that the universe is expanding as a tool to determine the distance of objects. The more distant an object is, the larger the redshift, the faster it appears to be moving away from us. And that effect can be measured directly from measuring the spectrum of the object, and that gives us a direct measure of their distances. So it's actually quite a different effect from the one that you're talking about. And the effect that you're talking about can really only be used for relatively nearby stars.
Okay, Scott, thank you for raising that. It's an interesting point. I'm glad we cleared that up. Let's go to Larry in Illinois. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My question isn't really related to the topic today, but it's an astronomical question. My question would be, is the matter in the universe, the so-called dark matter that's unaccounted for, has anyone considered the massless particles, such as photons, when they're in motion, they would produce a gravitational field? And could this account for the dark matter of the universe?
Okay, Larry, let's put that to David Weinberg. I suppose dark matter is part of this, or questions about dark matter are going to be addressed by the Sloan Sky Survey, right?
Yes, yeah, so I think, in fact, your question is extremely relevant to today's topic, because really much of the idea with both of these surveys is to use the visible to map the invisible. So the light that we see from galaxies is produced by stars, and stars are made of normal matter. They're made out of atoms of hydrogen and helium, but the same kinds of atoms that make up stars and planets and human beings. But we know that galaxies are held together largely by the gravity of dark matter, something that emits no light but does produce gravitational effects. Now, it is true that photons, particles of light, actually produce some gravitational effect, but we actually have a sort of direct measurement of how many photons there are in the universe, and we know that they don't have the properties or the amount required to explain dark matter. There are other similar particles called neutrinos, which are not massless but very light. And for a while it was thought that those might be the dark matter, but it turns out that they're still too light to be the dark matter. But one of the objectives of these surveys is actually to measure the mass of neutrinos. But particularly we'd like to get an accounting of how much dark matter there is and try to learn about its properties, learn about the relation between dark matter and the distribution of galaxies that we see. And then indirectly from that, also learn about dark energy, which is the even more mysterious thing that seems to be pervading even empty space and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate over time.
Okay. I thank you for answering that. But, you know, I wonder if I can turn back to you, Michael Strauss,
yes.
and just, you were talking about the redshift of very distant objects, and it's always bothered me. And I suppose this is just one of those conceptual questions, but if we know objects are moving away, the farther away, the faster they're moving,
yes.
Doesn't that suggest that we can backtrack to figure out where they all started from?
Yes, indeed. And when you go through that calculation, and it's a very simple calculation, you come to the conclusion that all objects were on top of each other, more or less in the same position. That is, let me be very word this very carefully here. The distance between any two objects was essentially zero at a time about 14 billion years ago, and we have a special name for that time. It's called the time of the Big Bang. Yeah. And so, indeed, that is it's that argument that leads directly to the conception of the Big Bang. The observation that there's a direct relationship between how distant an object is and how fast it's moving tells us that all the objects were on top of each other, as it were, 14 billion years ago.
We're talking about mapping the sky with Dr. Michael Strauss from the Princeton University and David Weinberg from Ohio State University, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So if you can do that and you can give the time,
yes.
Can you give the place?
No.
Oh, darn.
Yeah, no.
I want to know, is it outside?
It's a specific moment in time, but it's not a specific moment in space. And the way to think about it, and this is not an easy concept to grasp, but the way to think about that is that the Big Bang didn't happen at a single point in space over there, as it were, but it happened everywhere. And what was involved in that expansion was not lots of individual galaxies spreading out into a space that already existed, but it's the space itself that was all scrunched together and expanded. And so it didn't expand into anything. And so your mental image of sort of standing outside this Big Bang and watching it go boom over there is not a correct one. There is no outside the Big Bang to stand out of. So one has to get one's mind around that. One way to think about that is to realize that, at least in our best models of how this all works, there is no edge to the Big Bang. There's no outside. The Big Bang happened everywhere at once, and it takes a little while to think get used to that idea. But we're used to thinking about being able to stand outside explosion and watch it. But the Big Bang is actually quite distinct.
Right. Well, we'll try to keep our minds open on this topic, even if the concepts are difficult. And let's try Mark in Philadelphia. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I had a much more basic question, and that is, I'm wondering whether anybody's ever considered whether or not the laws of physics outside our galaxy or our solar system is different from the laws that we observe inside our galaxy and on Earth, and that might account for things like dark matter, things like other findings that we might have that people find and are really unclear about. So it's really more thinking outside the box and thinking along the lines of how do we know that the laws of physics elsewhere in the universe are the same as the ones we measure here on Earth.
Mark, you're asking alarming questions, but interesting. David Weinberg, what do you think about that?
Well, it's an outstanding question, and it's one that astronomers are always asking themselves. So the way we approach things is really to assume that there are universal laws of physics that apply on Earth and apply everywhere else. But part of what we're always trying to do as we map further and further out is actually to test that assumption and see whether things like the strength of gravity or the speed of light or the strength of electricity might have changed over time and be different in different places. And so far with these surveys and all the studies that have been done, it seems as though you can explain everything with the same underlying laws of physics, though they're acting on different bodies in different places. But it is possible that the notion of dark matter and dark energy causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate, that the correct explanation may be not that these other things exist, but that our existing theory of gravity, which is Einstein's theory of general relativity, is in fact incorrect, that it describes the solar system well, but doesn't describe things on the scale of the whole cosmos. It's also possible that beyond this distance of 14 billion light years, which is really the most distant that we can see, that if you go much further, the laws of physics really might be quite different from what they are here. The physical constants, the speed of light, the strength of gravity could be different. This is an idea that's gained currency with string theory, because string theory, which is really a theory of fundamental particles, allows you perhaps to have
have events occur in different places of the universe that really make the interactions between particles and light very different as you go from one place to another. Unfortunately, if that's the case, these different laws of physics would occur in parts of the universe that we'll never be able to see.
All right. Well, that's an intriguing thought right there, but I'm afraid that's going to have to be our final intriguing thought for this hour. I'd like to thank both of my guests for joining me. Michael Strauss is a professor of astronomy at Princeton University, and David Weinberg is a professor of astronomy at Ohio State University. This program is produced by Annette Heist and Erica Altman. Charles Bergquist is our director and web producer. Our intern is Todd Neal. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For internet mail, it's scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you from the iTunes Music Store. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on Teacher's Link on the ScienceFriday.com website. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.